What's going on with measles vaccination worldwide?
Nebulized antiviral agent to combat COVID.
Does the Danish study really tell us anything about the utility of masks?
And what's a poly pill? How can it be used for cardiovascular disease?
That's what we're talking about this week on Double T Health Watch, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a Baltimore-based medical journalist.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
In keeping with what we've been doing the last several weeks, Rick, I'm going to ask you to start. Which would you like to choose?
Elizabeth, let's talk about this nebulized antiviral agent used for COVID infection. This is an antiviral therapy that's designed to be given inhaled, nebulized, because as we're aware, the COVID virus primarily affects the nasal pharynx and the respiratory tree. We can actually give an antiviral agent to a higher level in those areas without the toxicity associated with giving it intravenously. So this is the use of beta interferon. It's known to be a cytokine that modifies the immune system. There are 101 patients randomly assigned to either a single daily nebulized beta interferon or placebo. These were people who were in the hospital, about two-thirds of them on supplemental oxygen, and they followed them over the course of 14 days. That's the duration during which they received either the nebulized interferon or placebo, with the intent of seeing if they improved clinically. Those that received the nebulized were twice as likely to end up with really no significant symptoms at the end of the 14-day period. Now, it was a small study. It was underpowered to detect whether it improved mortality, and it didn't improve hospital discharge, but it actually did improve resolution of symptoms of those who received it.
Let me just say, this is in the Lancet Respiratory Diseases. Tell me about your thoughts on inhaled therapies for this particular disease. And also, there's been a rather disappointing set of results, I would say, relative to beta interferon.
Most of the time, it's given intravenously. To get to the high enough doses that you really need, it requires such a high dose that there's a lot of toxicity associated with it. So the advantage of the nebulized treatment is you can give a large local dose to the area that's affected without all the systemic manifestations. Again, this is a very early study. We need larger phase 3 trials, but the local application via nebulizer is much more attractive to give it intravenously.
Yeah, I get that. I'm just also a little bit skeptical, if you will, relative to the benefits of interferon, because other trials have been disappointing.
Probably has to do with a couple things. It may have to do with the individual syndrome that you're treating. When do you give it, early in the disease or later in the disease, and how is it delivered as well?
And certainly we've seen other strategies and other therapies that are inhaled that seem to be pretty effective also. So I guess we'll see more of that. Let's turn to Annals of Internal Medicine. Does this study really tell us anything about the efficacy of masks? This was a Danish study. It was conducted in Denmark between April and May of 2020. They recruited people who spent more than 3 hours per day outside their homes, but without occupational mask use. They had an intervention group and a control group. In their intervention group, they provided them with 50 surgical masks and instruction on how to use them properly. Their primary outcome measure was SARS-CoV-2 infection in the mask wearer at 1 month. And they used antibody testing in order to assess that primarily, but they also had PCR or hospital diagnosis. They had actually more than 3,000 participants assigned to wear masks, and just under 3,000 were controls. Of that number, just under 5,000 completed the study. They basically found that surgical masks, in supplementation to other public health measures that were in place in Denmark during this time to reduce the spread of SARS-CoV-2, did not result in what they were hoping for, a 50% reduction in infection rates. This was a little bit disappointing. Now, let me turn to the editorial, which was written by Tom Frieden, the former director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, who points out that there's a lot of things about this study that probably are not really very applicable to larger situations. When I read through this, primary among those was the fact that compliance with mask wearing was less than 50%. So it's pretty hard to say, hey, it works or it doesn't work if you're only using it half of the time. Other factors that were also corrosive relative to the results of the study or the conclusions of the study were the fact that at that time, the rate of transmission among community-dwelling folks in Denmark was low. So tell me what your thoughts are on this and how it got published in Annals of Internal Medicine.
Elizabeth, I agree. I think that the study has very significant limitations. What they set out to ask was, if you do all social distancing, does the addition of masks provide additional benefit? And unfortunately, at the end of the study, we don't have any answers to that. So, as you said, the transmission rate was low, the mask use wearing was low. The use of antibody testing is particularly a bad way of figuring out whether someone had infection or not. And by the way, a significant number of people that they enrolled in the trial didn't even complete it. So, for all those reasons, I don't think it really gives us any information. By the way, I wouldn't have published this because I think the study is a very poorly done study. But most of us have preconceived ideas about what works and what doesn't. We think masks work. And to be able to publish an article that says, well, we're not quite so sure, it's a little courageous to do that. So I applaud them because you don't want to not publish stuff because it doesn't meet with your preconceived ideas.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that in the current climate, particularly here in the U.S., this is the kind of study that it concerns me that someone's going to seize on it and say, hey, this is abundant evidence that masks don't really work and I don't want to wear it.
I agree with you. Someone may misconstrue this. That's why I appreciate Tom Frieden writing that editorial that said, hey guys, this doesn't really answer the question. So you really can't rely upon this to justify not wearing masks.
Okay, on that upside, I'm going to accept that. Let's turn to the New England Journal of Medicine. This is yours, this abundant evidence that poly pills are actually okay in people without cardiovascular disease.
I must say, I'm skeptical of using poly pills. You say, well, first of all, what is a poly pill? That's a pill that has a number of different ingredients with it, all at a regular dose. This particular poly pill that was studied has a statin, a couple of medications, three to lower your blood pressure. You could potentially combine them in a single pill that could lower cardiovascular risk in individuals that have never had cardiovascular disease but are at increased risk of it. And that's exactly what this study addressed. It took almost 6,000 participants who didn't have any evidence of cardiovascular disease, but they were at increased risk based upon their age, their gender, and the underlying conditions. And they randomized them to either placebo or to a poly pill or to the use of aspirin or to both of those together. Use of a poly pill plus aspirin reduced the risk of cardiovascular disease by 31% over the course of 4.5 years. A couple caveats. There was a higher risk of hypotension and dizziness in this group. Before they got the poly pill, they had a run-in phase. That is, they tested it first to make sure that people could tolerate it and would take it. And what they discovered in that initial run-in phase, about 15% of people either couldn't tolerate it or wouldn't take it. But those that actually completed the trial, there was a significant benefit to the use of a poly pill plus the use of low-dose aspirin compared to placebo.
I think this sounds like a great strategy for people in developing countries and potentially even here in this country where we're concerned about the cost of prescription medications and just how onerous it can be to be on multitudes of medications and try to remember your scheduling and dosing and all that sort of stuff.
The advantage of this is it's all in one pill. People take it once a day, less expensive. You can manufacture this pill for $15 a month in India. The downside is it doesn't allow you oftentimes to optimize. You want to get the blood pressure down to a certain level or cholesterol down to a certain level. So if that's your goal, the poly pill is not the answer. But if that's going to inhibit or prevent people from getting any therapy at all, the poly pill can be useful.
And I would just add that I'm going to look forward to more long-term data on this particular strategy to see whether addressing all of them at one time simultaneously with just a single medication is going to achieve the outcomes we'd like to have.
All right, Elizabeth, let's go to your next one. We're talking about global therapies and global treatments.
This is a little bit disappointing from Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Progress toward regional measles elimination worldwide between 2000 and 2019. I just want to remind the majority of our listeners that measles is really a pretty miserable disease, and it is associated with mortality. And the other thing that I think is really noteworthy about measles is just how very contagious it is. And right now we've got this pandemic screaming along of COVID-19. Measles remains in environments. Everybody catches it if somebody is shedding measles viruses. And so this, I think, is a particularly dire situation. They were looking at what's going on since, as I said, 2000 to 2019. And worldwide, it was really looking pretty good. From 2000 to 2016, they actually saw that the incidence of measles declined until 2016, but by 2019, it was on the rise again. As we know, this is a vaccine that requires two doses, and so they divide the data into how many kids get the first one and how many get the second one. And unsurprisingly, also, I guess I would know the number who get the second one is lower than the number who got the first one. But worldwide, again, we're seeing this very disturbing decrease in the number of kids who are even getting the first dose. And there are certain countries, of course, and that also is somewhat predictable, that are experiencing more of this than other ones, many of them in the developing world. But actually, here in the US, we have pockets of people who are vaccine deniers and who are not getting their kids immunized. And we've had noteworthy outbreaks that we've actually reported on. From 2000 to 2016, annual measles incidence decreased 88% and then increased 567% in 2019. How about mortality? They say measles vaccination prevented an estimated almost 26 million deaths globally since this program has been incepted. I have this big concern about this decline in measles vaccination that's going on right now. Similarly, we're also seeing that with other routine immunizations worldwide. And my concern that we're going to see a resurgence of infections like this.
To me, the numbers were pretty striking. Just since 2016, the global measles mortality has increased almost 50%. It's a failure to vaccinate, and particularly among the younger and older groups, that is, those that are most likely to have mortality as well. When you dig underneath a little bit, there are several things. You mentioned one, is if people get the first vaccine, they'll get the second. Some of that has to do with delivery and with storage. Some of it has to do with trust, by the way. When they looked at different countries, there were some groups that were less willing to take up the vaccine because of concerns either about the safety or about the why it was being given it as well. Access to services is an issue. Social influences affect the confidence and motivation to receive the vaccine. Then there are strategic issues. And they're different for different countries, by the way.
Well, I think that this calls out a need to develop a comprehensive vaccination strategy because I believe that as our coronavirus vaccines start to get deployed, also, we're going to need to confront vaccine hesitancy on the part, especially of parents, and figure out how we're going to get everybody to say, you know, these are public health success stories, and we really need to make sure that we support this practice.
And in fact, Elizabeth, the WHO and other groups have actually outlined strategies called the Immunization Agenda 2030 and the Measles Rubella Strategic Framework 2021 to 2030 to address some of these issues that you mentioned.
On that rather sobering note, then, that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.